Members, guests, we need to begin. We have a full schedule today and need to be done and out of here by 10 o'clock. So in order to get through our agenda, we will begin. I know I have at least a couple of members that are unfortunately detained with other things, and just so the audience understands, I'm going to get up and leave too for a little bit because hopefully my vice chair shows up shortly. Representative, yeah, you can take care of it too. Anyway, I have a bill in another committee that I have to, our deadlines are so tight that we're going to have to get those done too, and that's partly why we're missing people. So I thank you all for coming today. First of all, we cannot do our minutes because we don't have a quorum yet. And so then we'll go on with members. We are going to be hearing the consumers and the consumer groups regarding the vulnerable adult and elder abuse. First, we will hear an overview. I believe we're going to hear from Mary Jo George first, and then the rest of the groups. So if you would like to join us, identify yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee. Oops, I just lost the microphone. Okay. My name is Mary Jo George, and I am the Associate State Director of AARP Minnesota, and today I'm here on behalf of the Elder Abuse Consumer Work Group that was appointed by Governor Mark Dayton. Thank you, Representative Keel, for the opportunity to testify in front of your committee today. We really do appreciate it. Today we would like to talk about our recommendations on how to improve the health and safety of elderly Minnesotans in nursing homes and in assisted living facilities in order to prevent and deter elder abuse. Our recommendations are included in Representative Olson's bill, which is House File 3468. By way of background, Governor Dayton asked AARP Minnesota to convene a work group in response to the shocking and sobering series in the Minneapolis Star Tribune that described both a broken system of care and a regulatory oversight that has failed to protect Minnesotans' older and vulnerable adults from abuse. The other members of the group, work group appointed by Governor Dayton and joining me today to outline our specific recommendations include the Alzheimer's Association, the Minnesota Justice Center, Elder Voice, Family Advocates, and Mid-Minnesota Legal Aid. Also joining us are a number of family members whose loved ones have been victim of abuse and neglect, and their stories will illustrate the need for systemic changes. Overall, our recommendations were guided by the fundamental belief that elder abuse is both intolerable and an affront to human rights. Further, our recommendations were guided by the work group's members' expertise and experience and the input that we received from many organizations, providers, and individuals who contacted us. No doubt, the failures in our public regulatory system demand action, and both the steps that now MDH is taking to address the backlog of complaints and the recent OLA report, which is the Office of Legislative Auditor report, are big steps in the right direction. However, with 400 cases reported to OHFC weekly, we believe our recommendations are needed as they call for broad systemic reforms in order to effectively deter abuse. Ultimately, we believe that public regulatory reform alone is not sufficient to address abuse. Madam Chair, I know you heard last week that you heard from many dedicated care providers, and we agree. We want to thank them for their dedication and their work. But this is really about systemic changes needed to address the many gaps that we have that exist in law today. Even the OLA report concluded that more must be done than simply fixing OHFC. This is because under our current regulatory system, many vulnerable adults in facilities that operate today are under limited state oversight. To that end, we have developed four action areas. And again, our members from our work group will be going into the specifics. The first is we must establish more rights for residents and families to address what is a significant imbalance of power between elders, their families, and the facilities that are caring for them. Second, We must work to pursue abuse more aggressively by strengthening both our civil and criminal laws to hold abusers accountable. Third, we must license assisted living facilities to establish basic protections such as discharge rights, adequate staffing levels, and training and safety standards, especially for those caring for people with dementia. And fourth, we do have recommendations for improvements to the OHFC as well to both prevent and deter abuse. Finally, I just want to say that we know that elder abuse in Minnesota is a shared, preventing elder abuse is a shared value, and we want to work together to be able to fix these problems. And we hope that we can garner bipartisan support and have a hearing on our bill as well. So at this point, I was going to hand it over to some of our story family members. Is that right,
Chris? That's right.
Okay.
And if I could ask Debbie Singer to come and Jennifer Siegel, if you would both come up.
You'd like to join us at the testifiers table? And while you're coming, as you join us, will you please identify yourself for the record? And
Madam Chair, committee
ma'am,
members.
Just 1 second, will
sure.
you? Members, we have quorum now, so let's quickly pass the minutes. I'm all of a sudden blank. Thank you, Representative Baker. Representative Baker removes the approval of minutes for March 7th. Any additions, corrections, or changes? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and the minutes are approved. Thank you. I apologize. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Dr. Debbie Singer. Thank you for this opportunity to share my personal experience with you regarding this important issue. My mother was a vibrant 92-year-old, independent, redhead who enjoyed many activities and had genuine concern for the welfare of others. In 2013, she moved to an independent assisted living community, believing it to be the best place that could meet her needs, allowing her to maintain her independence, and providing us peace of mind knowing the residents were monitored on a daily basis. My mother entered into an agreement with the assisted living facility that included daily I'm okay checks. As her daughter and caregiver, I was my mother's support system, medical advocate, and participated in her life several days a week. On October 24th, 2017, we met with my mother at 12:30. Housekeeping came at the end of the meeting to clean her room. We said our goodbyes, told each other I love you, and I told her I would be back in a couple of days. At that time, I did not know this would be the last time I would see my mother alive. Over the next 24 hours, I assured out-of-state siblings that Mom was fine after they expressed concern over not receiving a return call from her after leaving a message. After all, the facility always called me when she had fallen in the past, and I knew from my mother's past comments that daily checks had occurred. 2 days after the meeting, I called my mother as I left work, leaving a message that I was on my way. When I arrived, 2 days of newspapers were on her table outside her door, along with activity papers from the facility and some boxes of formula. My heart started pounding as I knew something wasn't right. She never left her newspapers outside her door. Her door was unlocked, and when I opened it, it was dark. I flipped on the light switch, and to my horror, she was lying lifeless, reclined in her lift chair, wearing the same clothes she had on at our meeting. She was laying at an angle with her legs hanging over the end of the footrest, blood on the floor, the footrest in the back of her chair. Her entire neck was bruised. There was an odor present, and my stomach turned. She clearly did not die peacefully. The foundation of trust I had built with the facility suddenly crumbled beneath me. The police never arrived, the medical investigator made mistakes, and the director of nursing, as I would later discover, falsified information in my mother's record regarding her death. Clearly, the daily I'm okay checks were not occurring. And the daily check was to occur as follows. The resident was to push a button by 10 a.m., and if they didn't, a phone call would be made to their apartment. And if they didn't answer, a person was sent to the apartment. A daily I'm okay check is a simple and basic procedure that not only attends to the resident, but provides families peace of mind and trust in an assisted living facility. Daily checks were in my mother's contract and resident services manual. As a veterinarian, we are entrusted with pets that people consider members of their family. I believe we provide better basic monitoring and supervision to ensure pets are not only okay, but provided compassionate care without abuse and neglect, whether it's at a vet clinic, a boarding facility, a doggy daycare provider, or a pet sitting service. Our elders and other vulnerable adults deserve the same and more, and I want to ensure that no other family has my experience. How do I do that? I am respectfully requesting the members of this committee commit to licensing assisted living facilities based on details developed by our Elder Abuse Coalition work group. Further studies are not needed to determine the prevalence of these situations of abuse and neglect. Costs will only go up and further lives will be lost. We need action, and the time is now. As you know, the Office of the Legislative Auditor has recommended licensing of assisted living facilities, and I would hope that you would act on that recommendation. Thank you for your attention and consideration.
Thank you. Just FYI, members, we'll go through all of the testifiers before we ask any questions. Would you go ahead?
My name is Jennifer Siegel. I am a registered nurse. I am here today off of work. I am here as a caring individual of elderly people that I have worked with for many years. I have a responsibility to my patients and to myself to act out on matters of injustice and human rights for those most vulnerable. I work full-time in home care. Public speaking and public policy are new and uncomfortable for me. But as I learn more, I see that to make a difference on a larger scale, I must get involved. We have a massive public health problem that is deep and complex on many levels. For over 20 years, I have worked in long-term care, assisted living, memory care, home care for Medicare and Medicaid, and private pay. I provide direct care, I supervise staff, and I provide education to staff and family. I do a lot of care management and care coordination on elder care because this is so complex. It's confusing and overwhelming and a very emotional time for patients and their families. It has become so complicated that people need to hire me as a navigator. I'm not here to tell you more stories of abuse. I've seen it. I've heard it. I've felt it. I'm enraged by it. Over the years, I have made numerous reports to Adult Protection. I have filed with OHFC. I have made calls to 911. I have never, ever received a collaborative call back on anybody. I'm here to tell you that as a mandated reporter, I have made so many reports in my career, the investigative agency does not respond. The only response I get is the standard letter stating, we have reviewed your report and there is no evidence to support. We're just encouraged to call back again if there's another problem. I have had patients give me pictures to submit and they will not take them. I cannot add to the report if I return to the person's home the next day to find something. I agree with the consumer group. Families need transparency and report information. I would add that a reporter needs information, too. Until now, I have always thought that the secrecy had to do with privacy. However, it is clear to me now that the secrecy has more to do with the covering up of the backlog and the dysfunction. Where does this leave providers like me? I'm obligated to report, but I have no trust that my report is being taken. I have no way to follow up, and I have no way to add extra information. In healthcare today, we have a wide variety of staff from many different cultures and backgrounds. There are cultural differences in approach and beliefs of elder care. In some cultures, dementia is believed to be a mental illness. This belief is so overpowering that people are isolated or buried alive. So we have caregivers from other countries, and if we're not properly educating what the cultural norms are here, we've not done a good job. The dementia care training over the last 20 years, the requirements that I have received is a video by Lisa Givens, an expert on dementia. This is pretty standard. Dementia is very complicated, and it deserves good attention and education. In closing, I would like to emphasize that action should be taken. Staffing must be a priority. More state investigators are needed. Abusers and the corporations that continue to employ them must be held accountable. We need to gain trust in the regulatory agencies by a system overhaul. Assisted livings must be regulated. There are more and more people living in assisted living, and there's less oversight. The home health aides have no choice but to call 911 for something that doesn't really require 911 because there is no nurse in the building to help them through. So they're doing what they think is best. So there's many unnecessary ER visits, ambulance rides, etc. Thank you for your time. A professor of mine recently reminded me that there is no justice without action. Please help us.
Thank you very much, ladies. I appreciate your calls, your comments. And also, thank you very much for your service. Appreciate it, whether it's for family or to fight for the rights of others. Very much. It's a noble job. Thank you. I believe we have Mr. Lynn and Eric Lynn and Lauren Edstrom. You would like to join us?
Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Lynn. Welcome back. And thank you very much. And would you please identify yourself for the record? And you can go ahead with your testimony.
Representative Peel, members of the committee, good morning. I'm Eric Lynn from Central Minnesota, Avon, Minnesota. This is me. I was a part of that Star Tribune story. It's not really the teacher story I wanted our family to be a part of, but I'm going to do what it takes to correct this injustice. I'm the oldest of five boys in our family. Our mother, Irene, was diagnosed with Alzheimer's at the age of 58. Mom recently passed away in April at the age of 65. Thank you for your time today. Our story has been nothing short of a nightmare. In reference to the Consumer Work Group report, this report addresses a lot of what my family went through as we moved Mom from facility to facility. As I said, I was a part of the Star Tribune series that got this thing going. So Mom was a caregiver herself, working as a nurse's aide for over 20 years, oftentimes taking us boys to visit the residents she cared for. Mom's third and final facility was the very place she worked at for so many years earlier in life. Alzheimer's was a devastating blow. We had no idea at the time just how devastating it would be or the challenges that lied ahead. As young boys, we lost our father, Ron, to a farm accident at the age of 42. Somehow our mother persevered through it all, never putting her own pain or well-being first. Mom raised us, kept our small farm going, and worked full-time, never missing school events or activities, including church on Sunday. After diagnosis in 09, she lost her job, her privilege to drive, her home, her dog, her livelihood. The disease progressed quickly. We became caregivers overnight. We didn't know anything about the stages of the disease or the storm that was about to hit. Mom's care became overwhelming for our family to manage. Keeping Mom in her home was a safety concern as well as a financial challenge. You make the very difficult decision to move your mother to an assisted living or memory care facility, or what you think is memory care. Your belief is that the care facility is surely licensed and has professionals, RNs, LPNs, caregivers that have more understanding and education to provide the level of care they promise you and charge for. After all, this is what the brochure states. This is what the website shows. You finally convince yourself and the family to visit a facility. You're greeted by the manager or owner, oftentimes the former realtor or building manager, with no clue about the care needs of a potential resident, let alone the effects of Alzheimer's. They show you the beautiful leather couch and the stone fireplace. They promise a home-cooked meal which your loved one can even participate in if they like to cook or help. At bath time, they like to offer a resident a glass of wine if it's okay with family to offer a relaxing spa-like bathing experience. You look at each of your family members a little surprised by these concepts, thinking, wow, this is great. In our case, the housing manager who gave the tour was also part owner in the facility, also the RN holding the license overlooking the residence. Little did we know we were staring in the eyes of a wolf dressed in sheep's clothing. She had a bed to fill and knew exactly what to say, knowing she couldn't provide what she promised. 5 months into Mom's stay at the first facility, Mom walked away. The as-advertised memory care facility with unsecured doors had failed, this being one of our concerns at admission due to Mom trying to leave her own home under our care. Mom walked through a residential neighborhood, crossed a major county road, only to be discovered by a vigilant neighbor working in his yard. Mom was confused due to an undetected urinary infection. This brought us to an ER, then a psych ward several hours away. 11 days later, after a difficult stay over Mother's Day, Mom was discharged back to the facility. Was to be discharged back to the facility. Over a conference call with many professionals that helped get Mom back on track, the facility stated they would not readmit Mom and cancel their housing agreement. We would either have to take Mom home or find placement in another facility. This was very difficult with only 24 hours to find placement and move her belongings. We did find another memory care unit with secure doors. The trauma of two ambulance rides, the ER, the psych ward, and then another new home took a heavy toll on all of us. The second facility offering locked doors was the extent of their memory care. The incompetent care was just too difficult to accept. We had to be at the facility caring for Mom, bathing, feeding her. They could not provide basic cares. She eventually became so over-medicated she was near death on a very strong dose of Haldol. Again, we trusted the facility. The third facility under a competent, compassionate RN gave us hope. Mom's condition improved and she actually rebounded. 3 months into Mom's stay, the RN was chewed up by an administrator that cared about filling beds and charging for everything possible. The nurse soon left the facility and we were right back to daily challenges. Lack of leadership and Mom's condition would soon show the effects. Our family was at Mom's side every day to help with meals, bathing, one-on-ones, common needs that each facility promised but struggled to provide adequately. In her dying days, under a strict care plan put in place by a very professional hospice team, the facility failed to communicate and follow the plan. Both final days, they didn't rotate the two important meds to keep Mom pain-free and resting comfortably. We were forced to take Mom to my home to die and assure dignity under our watch. Every dollar our mother worked for, saved and saved, went to three facilities. She paid to be neglected and kicked down the road over and over and over again. Kicked down the road with nowhere to turn, only to find yourself staring in the eyes of another wolf in sheep's clothing. If you don't like it, get out. If you cause problems, we'll evict you. We'll take the next person on the list. Bring the checkbook and we'll show you the leather couch. A kick the can solution is not enough. Families like ours can't wait another day, much less a year or two or five, for more groups to talk about the problem. We need solutions today. This is an injustice that must be corrected immediately. It's time to eradicate those that continue to turn a blind eye to neglect and abuse. It's time to assure quality care with dignity and respect to all institutionalized, no matter their age or ailment. No more deceiving brochures, websites, advertising falsely, promising families that what they cannot provide. Price gouging after admission for extra services provided, knowing a resident's needs will change and increase. Give families of loved ones rights to obtain records from the state regarding reports filed in life and after death if they choose. Families seeking civil litigation are told no after a loved one dies due to neglect and abuse such as ours. It's about doing what is right 100% of the time without a doubt, starting at the top. It's not to see what we can get by under state minimum or loopholes in licensing. Let's raise the bar in all aspects of care to prevent this injustice. Many new caregivers each and every day are put in charge of our loved ones with little or no training, mentorship, or guidance of any kind. Facilities put these caregivers at risk as well. If you're a plumber, electrician, a mortician, a police officer, firefighter, just to name a few, you must go through oftentimes years of apprenticeship before working alone in your profession or being eligible to take a state exam for your license. In many cases, our most precious family members may not see an RN or an LPN until the problem arises. A problem arises or a care partner identifies something. At best, a report is read with no human interaction to the resident or the family. Our mother lost her fight with Alzheimer's, but her voice will continue to speak loudly to represent all those that have been neglected and abused. Thank you for your time today. As elected officials, my plea to you is to ensure proper legislation is in place to protect our most vulnerable citizens.
Thank you, Mr. Lynn. I appreciate your testimony.
Thank you, Deb.
And your willingness to speak out also. Lauren Edstrom,
yes.
Right?
Yep, my name is Lauren Edstrom. My mother has early onset dementia, and I'm here today because this is really the only thing I have left that I can do. I'm 34, I'm an only child, and I did the best that I could by her. She moved to an assisted living facility last year, and the purpose was solely for socialization because she was becoming isolated in her apartment. I couldn't do everything for her, but she was still going to the grocery store and driving her car to church or whatever, you know, just short trips back and forth. But I convinced her that this new place that opened up that accepted the elderly waiver, which I knew was few and far between because of many of the calls that I've made, a brand new building, she could pick her room, pick her floor plan. There was promises of activities. She was nervous, but I sold her that this was going to be a really good opportunity. There were going to be people there that understood what she needed, and that she wouldn't have to drive to go to the grocery store. There would be a bus, and they could ride together. She was lost. They didn't know what to do with her. I was getting up to 30 calls a day, and I would be in my office at work, or I'd be home with my toddler trying to get him supper, and I'd be helping her over the phone when I couldn't be there in person, navigate the super long hallways with like 40 doors down each corridor, get her way back to her room, because after a few days, she started to get turned around, because it was a really pretty building, but it wasn't designed for people who were just coming from their house to understand how to navigate a big building like this. There weren't any signs to go to the dining room. There weren't any signs to find their way to the laundry room. So eventually she started to get so nervous that she just didn't want to go down to eat supper. I asked for escorts, but I had to call every meal for every day to make sure that would happen or leave my office and go and make sure that she got what she needed. She would start walking around in the middle of the night because she was going to bed at 5 o'clock when it got dark, because she didn't know what else to do with herself, which to me said that no one was really checking on her and nobody knew that she was walking around but me. And the only reason I knew that was because I would get the call at 3 o'clock in the morning because she didn't know what time of the day it was. She wanted to see what I was doing. I mean, there was a lot of people there that were very nice, and then like two specifically were the two environmental services ladies who saw my mom struggling right away on the assisted living side, and they actually got her like a rag and something that she could walk around to help them because they wanted to make her feel useful so that she could have some activity to kind of get used to the building. They were the only people that cried when she left, and they wanted to make sure that they said goodbye when she moved out, and they could feel her anxiety, and they could feel how hard it was for her from this transition. Within 10 months, my mom was lied to, stolen from, neglected, and bullied, and her health declined so rapidly that she ended up in memory care after 2 months. My personal opinion is that my mom did not belong in memory care. She was just not transitioning as quickly as they had hoped, and they didn't have the staff to help her adequately transition, and they were asking me questions like, what can we do to help your mom? What should we be doing? Again, I'm 34. This isn't what I do for a living. She's just my mom, and I'm doing the best that I can. The police officer I spoke to when she had her bank cards and her wallet stolen by a staff member said that he had an aunt who lived there, and he had the unfortunate experience of talking with them today after having several rounds of unfavorable conversations of his own with the staff regarding his own family situation. I filed a claim, but that claim was unsubstantiated about 9 months later because that staff person didn't actually use that credit card, even though she admitted to taking her wallet, and she did lose her job, and the police officer was there, and there was a police report. Because she didn't buy anything with it, technically it didn't really happen. So that individual can go and get a job somewhere else and just do a better job taking someone else's credit card. My mom moved into memory care. There were only 8 people. They sat in the same 2 rooms and watched TV, just back and forth. I had other residents of the building that I would talk to when I was coming and going, because by now I'm the eyes of memory care. And they said that whenever there was a barbecue or something happening in the building, people in memory care never left. The only thing they were supposed to do was to take my mom up to the church service on the 2nd floor. They never did that. I called and I asked. I had emails. I have call trails. We had care conferences. I updated her care plan. I called the ombudsman. I researched the corporate company in Chicago, and I called them. They didn't know I was calling, but they called me back, and they promised that there would be messages transferred back. None of this made any difference. Nothing I did improved anything for my mom. She missed meals. She missed medications. She was alone. They just didn't have time to help her figure it out. They weren't taking her on any of these trips that they had. They weren't involving her in any of the activities. They wanted me to put her in memory care 2 weeks after she moved into assisted living just so that she would stop wandering around. So once she got into memory care, her health began to decline because she was just sitting there all day. She started having falls. She fell once and fainted, and it was noted in her chart, and no one called to tell me about that. And because of an MRI scheduled that week anyway, I found out she had a stroke at that time. So she fell, and she had a stroke, and no one bothered to call to tell me. I tried my best to find a new place for her to live, again, on the elderly waiver, and with close proximity to me, that was difficult, but I was willing to drive halfway across town. And I have found some place where she is now, where she is safe, and she is happy, and the difference is incredibly overwhelming that we lasted as long as we did in this particular facility. You shouldn't be medicated for having dementia and trying to figure out where you're going just because you're walking and that's irritating the staff people. There should be, you know, if you have a giant building, there should be more than just two people that are working so that they can see somebody lonely and wandering in the halls in the night. It shouldn't be up to the family members to have to call and ask for these things that are already on the care plan. It shouldn't be my responsibility to make sure that my mom is eating and getting her medicine and safe. I mean, when you trust, when you're sold on the buildings, when you go in there, you're in a position already where you're feeling awkward, and you're just going on your gut. And sometimes your gut isn't always right because you just really want to believe that what you're going to be doing is the best for your loved one. And frankly, I don't really know very many places that you can walk in and just immediately feel safe. There's good people out there and the good caregivers who are working so hard for not a large paycheck, and we, the families, are putting a lot of responsibility on them, and that's not fair, and it's not their responsibility to carry the entire facility because they do a good job. I was told I couldn't have a camera in my mom's room. I was told that I would be followed up with by management and things would change. I was told before she moved into the building that she would be treated differently than she was. But I just want to know who's going to hold these people accountable for the broken promises, because ultimately I can't show you a picture of a broken bone or an open wound. I can't show you a physical injury that my mom has. But the psychological damage that happened to her in 10 months, and just from being feeling unsafe and weary and not knowing who she can trust in her own home, and moving her three times in less than a year and a half, has done a toll that I won't ever get back. So I'm just here today to say thank you for letting me share my story. I know there's a lot of issues out there, but the work group has put a lot of effort together to put some suggestions that I think would be an excellent starting point. And I just hope that regardless of the amount of money somebody has, whether they're a private pay resident or they're on the elderly waiver, that their care options are the same, and the rules should apply for everyone.
I thank you very much, Lauren, for your testimony. And sorry to hear that your mom's had so many struggles.
Thank you.
With that, we would invite Irene McCormick and Corey Tanner to the testifying table. Welcome, I assume, Ms. McCormick, and would you please begin by identifying yourself for the record?
Yes, my name is Irene McCormick, and I'm here today to tell my mother's story. She was in three different facilities. She initially ended up there because I was initially caring for her. She had a stroke, and the doctor said that she could no longer be cared for by only me. I couldn't do it by myself. And so at that point, I decided to find a facility for her. And the first place that I put her in was a nursing home. And she wasn't cared for at all. I had met with them multiple times to go over her care plan and what she needed. And I went there every single day, morning, noon, night, didn't matter. I went every day. And there was always something happening. And every time that I made a complaint or tried to meet with someone, things escalated and got worse. And ultimately, some of the worst things that happened, my sister was in town. And so my brother and I, my sister, went to see her one evening. And it was in the evening, and she She was sitting with, like, a sweater pulled down, and I noticed when it was time for us to go that I was going to get her ready for bed instead of having the care people do it. And I noticed that she was sitting in a pool of urine in her chair with a dining room tablecloth shoved down the back of her chair to soak it up because they never took her to the bathroom. As a result of all of that, she ended up having a horrible urinary tract infection. And one of the nights that I went to see her, they left her on the in the room. I went and I took her to the bathroom, and she didn't look well, and she passed out on the toilet. And so there was a bell to ring it to have somebody come in, and no one came. And I propped her up against the wall, and I had my cell phone, and I called 911. And the ambulance came. They got up in the room with a stretcher before anyone entered her room. There was no one around on the floor. They took her to the hospital. She was in there for a few days with a horrible urinary tract infection. And she ended up back there. And it was an ongoing thing. Same situation. They couldn't give her pills. It was always something. And when I had had enough and was complaining about it, they said one day, well, your mom got up and was walking around. So we're going to have to put her in the memory care unit. My mom didn't have, even though she had dementia, she did not have any behavioral issues other than, you know, rolling around in her chair. She didn't walk, so she never got up to walk around as they said that she did. So they threatened to put her in this lockdown unit that was for people with behavior issues, and it was horrible. It was a small room, probably the size of this room, and people were just wandering around, and nobody did anything with them. And I flat out said, over my dead body, are you going to put her in a lockdown unit? And they said, well, you have 30 days then to get her out. And so I did, and it took me 30 days calling everybody I could find. And finally I found someone who helped me find a place that was an assisted living. It was like a residential. It was more homey. It was like five townhome units. And it looked like more of a comfortable place. She was there for a while, and it was going well, and then all of a sudden the staff started turning over. And I was going there pretty regularly, 3 to 4 times a week. I didn't feel like I had to go every single day because it seemed like things were going well. And then one day I went there on a Sunday evening, and a staff member said, well, I don't know what's wrong with your mom. She's like screaming, and she's, you know, not doing well at all, and it was not her behavior at all. And I said, well, did you know, because they had a nurse there, but they said, well, she checked her and nothing's wrong. Everything's fine. So they just put her in bed. Well, I went and sat with her for a minute, and her leg was in pain, only to find out after I called 911 again, took her to the hospital, and her femur was broken in half. And they had taken her, and they left her in bed for I don't know how many days, and she was in pain. And the nurse, when they took the x-ray, was horrified to see that her femur was literally cracked in half. And it's just so disturbing that these places exist and there's no licensing and there's no trained people in there. And nobody wants to do anything about that. I mean, I can't wrap my head around it.
that nobody would want to have assisted living license, that people wouldn't want to have educated, trained people helping out to care for all of our loved ones, whether they're your parents or your grandparents or a child that can't, maybe had an accident. They're in there too. And it's horrifying and it's wrong, and until you experience it yourself, you have no idea. You walk in there and you see these, thank you, you see these places and you see these people, and it's horrifying. It's horrifying. How does somebody put somebody in bed with an ice pack and say, she'll be fine? And to make matters worse, after that, they put her in a splint. She had to go back to the facility. They couldn't keep her in the hospital. And so they said, well, you know, we'll have hospice come and help out. We'll get her a hospital bed. You know, we'll have her all set up. And so they were giving her morphine for the pain. And I said, well, that's fine. I don't want her doped up to the point where she's in a coma laying there. Well, that's exactly what they did. The hospice that came were giving her too much morphine. I had to call 911 again. She was transported to the hospital, and the emergency room doctor said, they're giving her far too much morphine. They're going to kill her if they keep giving her all of that, because elderly people can't process the medication the way we can. You know, you're moving around. You can eliminate it out of your system. If they keep giving it to an elderly person, it builds up in their system to the point that they die. So ultimately, I found another place and took her to a different nursing home. And again, my sister was in town visiting, and I went over there, and she was left laying on the bed. Now she's got a splint and this broken leg, and she's laying in the bed. Her leg is bleeding through the cast, and they just draped over a hospital gown and left her. No blankets, no nothing. She was just laying there like this with blood coming out of her leg. So I called 911. They took her to the hospital. And an orthopedic doctor said, well, you should just amputate her leg because it's never going to heal. And she's going to die. And she has dementia. She's not going to know the difference. And I said, get out. Get out of here. You know, she's 92 years old. I'm not going to put a 92-year-old through that. And so she stayed in the hospital for a while. She had an infection. They couldn't identify what it was at that point. And because she was in that last facility, from them moving her around in that Hoyer lift, they were jostling her leg. And so what happened, ultimately, the bone came through her leg. So it was sticking out of her knee. And that's how she was basically left. And, you know, I talked to my family. I was like, I'm not doing this again. And we took her home. And I did her care until she died. I did her wound care. I did her bathing. I did everything while she was in a hospital bed. And I would do it all again. I just wish I'd never put her in any of these places, because, I mean, my mom was never even on medication until she was on diagnosed with dementia. And to have all of this, you know, to think about somebody who lived through the Depression and lived through World War II and lived her whole life, worked her butt off her whole life,
raised a family and to get to this point in your life and you're treated like a piece of garbage in these facilities that, you know, are paid thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars for what? They do absolutely nothing. And honestly, you know, if they're doing a great job, then why do they care if there's, you know, cameras around and family members want cameras in there? Or if they want regulations, why should they be afraid of it? They're doing their job, then great. Then show everybody else how to do the job, because there's plenty of facilities and plenty of people in this room that have not had that experience. And it has to change. It's going to change. And I'm going to get justice for my mom by doing this. This is how you do it. And things have to change. And I'm not going to stop. I'm not going to stop fighting. And neither are all of these people. This is a human issue. This isn't a political issue. It's not Republican, Democrat. This is a human rights issue. People deserve to be treated with respect and dignity as they get older. We're all going to be there. We're all going to be in this place if we get that far. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. McCormick. I am sorry that all of this happened. I mean, I just can't imagine how difficult it is.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Tanner, would you identify us for the record? Identify for the record and
sure.
Go ahead.
I'm Corey Tanner, Madam Chair, committee members. I'm Corey Tanner, son of the late Mildred E. Tanner of Anoka, Minnesota. We had my mother's funeral this past Friday morning. I was the last of eight children and her baby. Mom and I lost my dad when I was 6 years old and my mother was the age of 50, 1 year after my 25-year-old sister passed away. My sister was born premature with cerebral palsy, bedridden her entire life. Cindy was unable to talk, feed herself, or clothe herself. My mother took care of her at home her entire life until she passed away, never wanting Cindy to be put in a state institution. I share all of this about my mother, and so I can explain who she was and the tremendous bond my mother and I had. I testified before the Senate Aging Committee just 2 weeks ago, telling my mother's story of what we believe was neglect in the nursing home where she resided. We wanted to share my mother's story to prevent the care concerns we had from happening to someone else. Today, I have the same concerns plus one more. Now, any claim of negligence essentially goes away, and the suffering that my mom experienced is simply ignored like she was. Her experience is difficult, and I'm here because it is too important to be silent. Nursing home neglect falls through the cracks. There is not a system in place today to quantify this sort of neglect. It's just the way it is. The problem is only going to get worse as our baby boomers become seniors and enter these facilities. It's time to stop these acts of neglect and abuse. Today, even though I'm grieving my amazing mother's death, and just a few days ago she was buried, I feel strongly that she would be here, though. Even though she has passed, I must fight for her rights that were taken away from her. So I bring myself here today fighting for her still. What I have with me is all I have left of my mother, it's her glasses. But if you could take a few minutes and listen to my story, maybe you can see through her eyes and change this law and allow people to make these people learn they cannot do this to our mom, dads, or families. I'm going to tell you about what I consider neglect and ignorance that expedited my mother's death, which would have eventually resulted passing away from dementia, not neglect. You're going to hear about conditions and ignorance that led to bed sores, neglect that led her to be alone in her room in the middle of the night in a wheelchair where she fell out and severely broke her ankle that required surgery, which led to opioid abuse, lack of communication, and violation of her health care directive and basic human rights. All of this happened to my mom, who probably had more visitors than anyone in the facility. And she was also, she had a great big Facebook following, so she had people from around the world following her journey through dementia. My mother was admitted to the hospital in the fall of 2014 because of complications from diabetes. It was during that hospital stay that Mom was diagnosed with dementia. My family and I had to move Mom to a nursing home facility to be cared for. Because her level of care was more than one or two of us kids could help her out with at home. In the late fall of 2015, Mom was moved to a different facility, which I told could better take care of her needs with her dementia, and she was moved into a lockdown memory care unit. Things were not what I had first thought, though, because it was going well, and things began to unravel. The unit that Mom was in was infested with mice. There were mouse traps everywhere in residents' bedrooms, in their closets. I caught a mouse in Mom's drawer. Any treats needed to be housed in metal cans, and anything left out was fair game for the rodents. Men and women came into my mother's room, sometimes removing clothing and sitting nearly nude in my mom's bed. Drawers would be gone through, and staff often ignored it, even after telling them over and over what was going on. We experienced delays in response from the aides after pressing the call light. My mother was told, because of her excessive request for needing to use the bathroom, that she would only be able to go at certain times during the day. If she needed to go in between, she would not make it, and she would have to wait. This led to soiling herself, and until somebody changed her, she would be sitting in this. And until someone took her to the bathroom, this went on for almost 2 years. Things continued to decline as I noticed a lot of inattentiveness from the staff, and they seemed annoyed to take care of my mother and others. My mother's nails were constantly filthy, her hair greasy, not combed, her dentures not in, no denture cream was applied. On more than a handful of occasions, Mom was given shellfish, even though the orders and her diet stated she was allergic to the food and should not have it. On February 20th, 2017, Mom broke her ankle, and I was told that she got out of her wheelchair in the middle of the night in her room. She was found on the ground with her ankles caught in the feet of the wheelchair. I was told it was her fault, although she was alone in her room and not in her bed. When I asked about the severity of the fall, they said she would need x-rays and was given pain medication. When I came to the nursing home, Mom was sleeping and oxycodone, and was given oxycodone and seemed okay while she would be awake. The social worker of the facility told me that she was not a doctor, but she was going to mention that oxycodone really seemed to work well for my mom's behavior. 3 days later, February 24th, I had to set up transportation for my mom to go to the emergency room, where I held her while she was screaming in pain as her leg needed to be reset to prepare for surgery. Mom underwent a very scary surgery, and the surgeon told me that Mom's bones were like drilling through potatoes, and she could probably never put weight on it again. After a few months, I talked to the orthopedic surgeon on Mom's progress, and I asked why the facility was still giving her oxycodone. He said that she should have been starting to get off of it at that point. In the nurse practitioner's notes that I received,
It indicates the orthopedic surgeon's recommendation that the oxycodone pain meds be discontinued. Mom was on the oxycodone not only as a scheduled medication, but as needed for a total of 8 months, receiving dosages at random times during the day and a lot of times before meals. We believe she kept getting the medicine partly because it made her easier for staff to be taken care of when she was sedated. Her weight was 171 when she broke her ankle. And when I finally demanded that she be taken off any sort of oxycodone in September, she was 133. She had lost over 40 pounds. My family and I were called to the facility on the morning of February 9th, 2018, and we were told that we should come because things had taken a turn for the worse. I was told that time was of the essence. When I arrived, it looked very bleak. Mom was close to death. I called my family in, and nearly 15 of us said goodbye, and we had the priest come in, and he gave her last rites. I didn't know how fast things had escalated. I was with Mom 2 days before helping her eat lunch. Now, at that point, we were moistening her lips with a little sponge. Mom's eyes were flashing open on and off. It got to be around noon, and Mom was still with us. I moistened her lips with the water, and she opened her eyes as if she wanted more water. I was told, do not give her any water that she could aspirate. Mom was somewhat alert when I gave her a little sip out of the straw. All of a sudden, Mom's eyes opened, and with a strong grip, she took the cup out of my hand and gulped it down and asked for another. And I said, Ma, do you want more? She drank one more. Growing stronger, she said, Corey, ice cream. Ice cream. It's kind of became our thing. So I asked if I could get her some ice cream, and she ate it. 2 hours later, she was drinking coffee, talking on the phone to her granddaughter, and eating fruit cocktail, and we were amazed. And I have a picture that I can show here later. The next morning, I came back to visit Mom, and she was wide awake on the bed. She ate a large shake I'd got for her. She looked good. My brother came in and sat with her and gave her lunch. I returned that evening with my cousin, wife, and daughter, and gave Mom her supper and another shake. She ate well, got a little tired, but she was alert. It took a little while to feed her with her shake. I was there about 3.5 hours and in the room, and not one person checked on her roommate. I had to go ask for my mom's dinner twice. The nurse told me that she had worked 14 straight shifts and they were short-staffed at that weekend because people didn't come in. I happened to ask what Mom's blood sugar was the day before, and they told me they had checked it Friday evening after we had got food in her, and it was 66, and that she had also got insulin. 66 is a very dangerous level, and that's even after I got food in. When I pulled Mom's records a few days later, this measurement was not in her records, nor was the insulin that was reported to be given her. So Sunday morning, I called and I asked how Mom was doing, and the RN said she was comfortable. So later on that day, I prepared couple of Mom's favorite sandwiches, orange juice, and brought it to her. I returned about 3:30, and when I got to my room, my sister called and said, you better come down. Mom's not looking good again. When I saw her, she looked very weak. She was drinking fluid. Mom told me she wanted water, so I gave her some of the orange juice that I brought for her. With about eight family members in the room, the RN came in and told me, she cannot let me give her any of the orange juice or food that she was going to aspirate. Even if she asks for it, you cannot give it to her. Another RN came in, and I asked her what happened since I had called in the morning and talked to her. She said Mom rejected her lunch and breakfast and I cannot give her food or water even if she asks. When she left the room, I called on-call hospice nurse to come in. Mom, at that point, was still asking me for food and water, so I began to give her water and some food, as I was doing the night before. The RN came back in and caught me and lectured me and my family members and told me that no matter how much she asks, do not give it to her because it's going to be a harder death on her. The on-call nurse arrived, and when the RNs got word of that she was there, they immediately went into Mom's room and closed the door. They returned and said they were going to discontinue Mom's meds, that Mom could not have anything to eat or drink. The on-call hospice nurse told me death was not imminent, but Mom would suffer a bad death if she were to aspirate, and I could not give her anything. My family again said our goodbyes. I went home and started planning Mom's funeral again. I returned the next morning to call the regular hospice nurse and asked her to meet me in Mom's room because I was upset because they told me Mom couldn't eat or drink when she wanted to. When I got there, Mom was drinking OJ, eating applesauce, and the regular daytime RN said, "Your mom is okay, she's swallowing good," and she didn't know what the RNs the night before were thinking. Her regular hospice nurse told me to go buy Mom a big ice cream shake and bring it back to her, which I did. Mom drank the shake and wanted an egg sandwich. The hospice nurse reinstated Mom's medications, except for the insulin, which she said she was leaving up to the nurse practitioner to decide. The nurse practitioner said Mom's looking good, and she no longer needed this insulin, and reduced the blood sugar checks to once a week. The next day, Mom was at the table, feeding herself, eating beef stroganoff. I bumped into the RN that told me not to give Mom food or water, and she said, "Well, I guess we're all on the same page now." We found that Mom's health care directive stated that she wanted food or water until the end. Unless it was artificial, then she did not want it. After seeing this picture that I provided, the mom almost dying, I made the decision to have Mom transferred out of that facility. It's scary to move someone with dementia out of a facility they've been in because it's very hard on them. But I know Mom didn't choose me to leave her in a situation like this to end her life this way. I took a risk and I requested that she leave there. I wanted her last days and weeks to be on her terms. I got arrangements, and by the grace of God, we got to leave there. Mom made it about three and a half weeks where she was in comfort. She was respected. She had the dignity she deserved. Mom passed away March 3rd, 2018. I was holding her hand. I whispered in her ear to go to heaven. I believe that the industry needs to know that until a survivorship law is changed that allows damages for pain and suffering, the neglect and abuse will not stop if there is no monetary consequences. Right now, neglect and abuse gets ignored because once a person dies, you essentially cannot file a suit and hold the responsible party accountable. Well, I'm here to tell you that my mom suffered. Our family suffered, and a lot of people in even worse situations than my mom, and I've been seeing them, have suffered. There's a lot more I could say, records I could show, and I'd be happy to. But I hope you see someone like my mom who suffered here. It's going to keep happening, particularly if the claim essentially goes away if the person dies. We must allow claims against vulnerable adults to survive with damages. Otherwise, the hope of change dies with them. So Mom is in heaven now, but I think she would tell me, Corey, now there's hell to pay. So
thank you, Mr. Tanner. And I think we all extend our sympathies to you, and I think that's something we need to look at, is when somebody passes away, that we continue investigations to find out what's going on.
So thank you both.
Thank you.
Next on the list, we have Sean Burke and Genevieve. Oh. She's not on the list? Welcome to the committee. And if you could state your name and start your testimony.
Madam Vice Chair and members of the committee, my name is Jacqueline Heron. I'm a wife, mother, grandmother, retired teacher, and author of a book which details my mother's elder care experience. My book's title, Singing Solo, In Search of a Voice for Mom, emerged as our family grew to believe that no one cared about the systemic failures of long-term care that diminished my mother's quality of life. I am here today to encourage support for the Consumer Work Group's recommendations that address elder abuse in Minnesota long-term care settings. I cheer the work group's efforts, and this is why. My mother suffered from debilitating vascular dementia, eventually becoming wheelchair-bound, unable to communicate, and a private pay resident of a well-reputed nursing home for the last 3 years and 8 months of her life. During my daily visits, I learned many things about my mother's nursing home experience. I learned that she thrived when compassionate caregivers treated her with dignity and respect. But I also witnessed many difficult days where her quality of life was negatively impacted by inconsistency of care from one shift of caregivers to another, failures to implement her care plans, such as when she was not repositioned or fed or given fluids so vital in her fight against urinary tract infections, injuries resulting from her care and then failures in protocol for these injuries, concerns regarding my mother's personal safety, as well as the security of her belongings. Many things disappeared, most heartbreaking, her engagement ring. I learned that person-centered care does not thrive in a facility marred by understaffing and high staff turnover. I learned that understaffed weekends and holidays can be especially scary times for nursing home residents. I learned that not every staff person is skilled in dementia care. And I learned that people with dementia, those who cannot speak or report, are especially vulnerable and in need of advocates. I wrote Singing Solo to shine a spotlight on long-term care realities that enable exploitation of residents, especially those who have lost their voices to dementia. During book discussions at dementia conferences, senior living residences, libraries, churches, and book groups, I have learned one more thing. Disturbingly, my mother's elder care story is not an aberration. Many, many families share the helpless frustration brought on by an elder care system that too often fails in its deliverance of safe, high-quality care. We look to people with clout, policymakers, and purse string holders to help us advocate for our vulnerable loved ones. Thank you for the work that you are doing toward this vital process, and thank you for the opportunity to share just a small snapshot of our family story. And I have brought books for your committee members if you'd like to read the entire story. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And next up we have Sean Burke and Genevieve Gaborio. If you could introduce yourself and start your testimony, that'd be great. Thanks.
Madam Vice Chair and members of the committee, my name is Sean Burke. I'm with the Minnesota Elder Justice Center. We are one of the five consumer members of the work group that we are talking about today. The Elder Justice Center is a statewide organization. We serve elders, persons with disabilities, and their families who've been victimized, abused, neglected, and financially exploited. This happens in our community by loved ones and in the residential settings and facilities that are subject of our consumer report. The people who call our office looking for help on a daily basis reflect many of the stories presented to the committee this morning. Our staff becomes frustrated when, after walking a victim or a family member through the maze of regulation, agency offices, legal issues, they get stuck when that caller asks them a simple question that too often doesn't have an answer. How can I right this wrong? How can I help prevent it from happening to others? Our work group looked at four areas of improvement. I'm going to talk about two of them. The first area is the enhancement and expansion of rights of consumers in care facilities. Specifically, we call for four changes. The freedom from retaliation and the expansion of what that actually means. The affirmative right to place a camera in one's own room. The freedom from deceptive marketing practices. And the right to discharge protections. When it comes to retaliation, our changes would clarify that after a complaint by a resident or a family member or an employee, certain actions taken by the facility would raise a rebuttable presumption of retaliation. This means that for families like Eric Lind and his mother, when they hear, if you don't like it, you can just leave, that's no longer just a bad business practice. It's a violation of her rights. As the work group sought to expand and enhance these rights, we recognized a fundamental truth, which led us to our second set of recommendations. Without better enforcement mechanisms, both civil and criminal, there are no teeth to these resident Bill of Rights. They're just empty promises on a piece of paper. At the Elder Justice Center, we train law enforcement officials, police, and prosecutors. And from them, we have heard the need for better tools, including the ability to bring tougher charges in instances where victims are terrorized and harmed, but no physical marks are left. This is what the statute calls demonstrable bodily harm. This language, which we suggest is eliminated from statute, prevents gross misdemeanor charges and issues even in cases of extreme harassment against vulnerable people. Enforcement of rights cannot happen solely, though, in the criminal area or the administrative area. No police force or state agency can respond to every bait and switch, every instance of retaliation, or every instance of physical or psychological abuse or neglect in settings where elders are receiving care. This is why, in addition to criminal changes and administrative changes, we also urge the adoption of additional civil remedies. These will equal the playing field. The purpose is simple. They will help ensure that the Bill of Rights provided to a resident upon entry into facility don't just remain those empty promises on paper. We suggest two specific changes. First, creating an explicit statutory authority, a private right of action, to enforce these bills of rights, both for the vulnerable adult and their family members. This mechanism would come with a fee-shifting provision to help ensure that vulnerable people can hire an attorney to help them enforce their rights. Second, as you just heard, we also suggest changing our survivorship statute. This would allow a court action to proceed after the death of an individual unrelated to the lawsuit. This change would fix the perverse incentive of a facility to draw out the litigation as long as possible, betting that an aging senior might die before the litigation can come to a close. As recognized in many other areas, consumer protection, disability rights, private civil enforcement remedies are not that controversial. They will provide much-needed teeth to the underlying promises contained in the Resident Bill of Rights. They will go hand in hand with criminal and public enforcement, providing a more robust set of protections and deterrence. I now want to shift over and turn it to my colleague, Genevieve Gabario. She's going to talk more about discharge rights for residents to appeal unnecessary evictions and prevent that carousel of broken promises suffered by the Lynns and others who testified this morning. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Burke. Genevieve, I was going to try and say your last name. I heard him say it. Will you go ahead and identify yourself for the records?
Yes, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm Genevieve Gabario, managing attorney with the Minnesota Legal Assistance. We serve the central 22 states with free legal services in Minnesota. And I specialize with senior rights. And before I go into my brief remarks about discharge rights and some elderly waiver proposals, I just want to highlight that we heard really personal stories and testimony this morning, and it was those stories and many others that informed the work of the workforce, the task force that we had. And so it's drawn from that, drawn from my clients, drawn from other consumer experiences that we really have put forward these recommendations. So for discharge rights, we're really kind of talking about three prongs. Right now, residents who are in an assisted living or housing with services facility, the owner can give them a 30-day notice to end their lease and doesn't have to help them find a new place, doesn't have to do anything. They're just like a regular tenant, a 35-year-old in an apartment who gets a notice to leave. And so we think that residents in these facilities who are receiving care need to have more protections, more similar to the way it is in nursing homes, where once you're in, unless you violate some certain things, you essentially get to stay there. And that matches what people's plans are. They don't plan to move from facility to facility. They plan to go somewhere and get their care there and stay in that place. So we would want to propose restrictions on terminations of leases once you're in. Also, if you move into an assisted living facility or a housing with service facility, and we have twice as many people living in these facilities as we have in nursing homes, they can give you as little as 10 days or, depending on the circumstance, 30 days notice when they want to stop your services. And under current law, they're not required to help you find additional services, replacement services. They can just say, we're done, we don't want to treat you anymore. And that effectively is also an eviction if they cannot bring in their own services. We would propose that when a facility wants to end services or wants to end a lease, that they be required to give longer notices, and that residents who think that there's something wrong with their lease or their services being terminated have a right to appeal. That's currently the model in nursing homes. We're not breaking new ground here. We're just kind of taking a system that already works really well and proposing that it be applied to these residents who are very similar. They meet a nursing facility level of care. They're basically, you know, very similar to nursing home residents, but just don't have any of these protections. So then the third part of the discharge protection, besides limiting terminations, allowing people to have a way to appeal if they're terminated, the third piece is if there are appropriate discharges, that people get assistance with that discharge. They get help to relocate to a new location. They have their list of medicines. They have their list of cares. They have their doctor's information. They have family input to help them get to that new location. So it seems fairly common sense that these are not current law, and we ask that this go forward this year. There's no need to wait for this to be part of an assisted licensing scheme. These are protections that could just common sense could be enacted now. And then the second resident right that I want to strengthen is we heard several people today talking about elderly waiver and difficulties finding a location that would accept elderly waiver. And elderly waiver, as you know, is the medical assistance portion that pays for services and facilities. So there needs to be more education of facilities about and families of how elderly waiver works. I hear clients who apply for elderly waiver, but they don't have the county complete the assessment in time, and so they're stuck with a huge bill that they can't pay because they qualify for it and are stuck with a few months of assisted living services bills that are just unaffordable. So there needs to be some streamlining and improving of that process, and we're also asking for a requirement that facilities take a small percentage of elderly waiver residents just as a way to make more opportunity and chance for people to live in the community in the setting they want to live in instead of being forced in a nursing home. So thank you. Those are my comments.
Thank you. I have one. You talked about the fact that you serve senior rights. Can you talk any more about, because this is addresses, the OHFC actually addresses 18 to end of life, so complaints. Mm-hmm. So my question is to you, do you deal with any other besides senior complaints, younger disability?
So at Mid-Minnesota Legal Assistance, we are a partner organization with the Disability Law Center, which serves Minnesotans all over the state with disability rights. So I personally only work with clients over age 60, but my office and other partners are very aware of other rights affecting people with different types of waivers. Yes, Madam Chair.
Let's wait just a little bit, okay? If you do you mind? Okay. I just wondered when she was talking about that. Thank you very much, both of you, and we'll call Ms. Schiller and Susie and Beth McMullen to the table. Thank you. Welcome to the committee, and identify yourself for the record, please.
Thank you. My name is Suzanne Schiller, a member of the Consumer Work Group and an elder abuse attorney. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm here to talk about one portion of the Consumer Group's recommendations, which is assisted living licensure framework. One significant charge that we had as a group was to look at the assisted living environment, and you've heard that quite a bit this morning. Some of the distinctions in the way the realities of care play out in a housing services establishment or an establishment that has chosen to have assisted living protection under 144G. So given that charge, we identified, as did the Office of Legislative Auditor report, supporting significant amount of these recommendations about the gaps that are currently in our system because of the way we have registered our buildings and licensed our home care providers. But those concerns really stem, our concerns related to producing or committing to an assisted living licensure framework really have two main points: confusing structure and system. Our consumers, and in fact our providers, our regulators, our attorneys, our legislators, we've heard from all sectors that this is a confusing system. So we're trying to adjust and balance consumer confusion with consumer choice. And we believe that we're committed and ask the legislator to be committed to striking that balance. Secondly, there are significant vulnerabilities currently in our assisted living structures and settings, including those with dementia. More than double the number of older and vulnerable adults live in assisted living. Somewhere around 60,000, and that could be higher because we don't track that as well as we do nursing home beds under federal regulation. In nursing homes, we have less than 28,000 roughly in our nursing homes, so we do have more than double. And many of those in our assisted living settings have complex care needs that require 24/7 assistance with basic living activities. From a 2014 study of long-term care providers from the National Center for Health Statistics, 58% of those in Minnesota in our assisted living are over the age of 85. That is significant. The National Center for Assisted Living also says that we have a higher than national average of those age 85 plus in our assisted livings, an average of 125 per 1,000, where the national average is 62 per 1,000. This points to the frailty, the complex care needs that we're currently experiencing in our assisted livings. 39% have dementia. 47% have cardiovascular disease, 60% need assistance with bathing, 37% in our assisted living, not just 85 plus now I'm talking, need assistance with toileting. So again, the level at which we're caring is more complex. This is a medical model. Oftentimes we may have thought of some social models that are appropriate, interlaced with our medical models, but make no mistake, this is a medical model that we need to keep up with. Currently, there are 1,649 housing with services establishments. 1,270 of those, 77%, have chosen assisted living title protection. That's a core group That's a significant amount of those in our housing with services establishments that are choosing to operate as an assisted living. There is a phrase that if you're operating as a assisted living, then let's license as a assisted living. Let's treat it as it is so that we can work with it as both providers and consumers. Of those 1,270, 586 have some type of dementia care status, 46% of those. So, again, playing out the frailty, the complex care needs, and the medical issues that we are dealing with and need to address in our assisted living settings. This housing separate from services leads to a whole host of challenges, including consumer confusion over two contracts, two regulatory structures. In fact, some would say that the housing piece doesn't have a regulatory structure. No appeals for discharge, which we just heard. Significantly, these are residential settings. Again, when you bifurcate the system of housing with services, you're really focusing on the care, which is wonderful in a home care bill of rights for an assisted living client, but you're ignoring the fact that they're a residential setting under the health care bill of rights. Assisted living is not currently mentioned in the health care bill of rights, and that's one of our recommendations, is to expand that residential setting of health care bill of rights to those who are living in a residential setting, such as assisted living. Minnesota is the only state that we have found that does not offer an assisted living license or a similar regulatory structure. We simply cannot ignore the fact that we are an outlier in this area. This is a time for committing to the assisted living licensure. We need systematic reform. It is the time for immediate change, followed up by discussions with all stakeholders to make the system as good as it can possibly be for the good of Minnesotans. California licenses residential care facilities. Wisconsin has community-based residential facilities. Florida licenses assisted livings. 18 of our states have a single assisted living license, period. That's how they do it. 31 states have a tiered approach or some multi-approach to assisted living license. Actually, in our recommendations, we're proposing some type of tiered approach to, again, accommodate consumer choice and balance the choice with the confusion. There are ways this can work now under assisted living licensure framework for the good of consumers, also for the good of providers, to provide that bright line where providers are struggling, saying, we can't meet this level of need anymore. You really need to be in a nursing home. It's a more appropriate placement. A brighter line in statute is a goal here for both consumers and providers to understand when that time has come. Upfront, clear. We recommend a plan to commit to this licensure. We also know that staffing levels need to be addressed, retention, training, monitoring, accounting for the medical needs that are before you, such as the acuity level that you're facing. Immediate licensure is needed for these gaps. Another gap is that not all physical plant standards have oversight, including food quality. Townships, certain entities may not have fire safety code reviews. So we are seeing that there's gaps in physical plant because of the way we register, and also that any inspection on fire safety, for instance, that may come in does not have the care needs in mind combined with their regulation for physical plant. A big piece of this is also corporate disclosure. Asking the landlord or the home care provider to step up and be the licensee of the whole setting. These are often affiliated entities. It's very confusing. We've heard stories where we don't even know who the landlord is to even address our concerns. So because of the way the base system is set up, many items, many concerns, many systematic gaps flow, and we're asking for those gaps to be filled with the assisted living licensure framework. I thank you for what you're doing, and I urge you this session to do all that you can to provide the framework that we can move forward for change. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Schiller.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Beth McMullen, and I'm Vice President of Government Affairs for the Minnesota North Dakota Chapter of the Alzheimer's Association. I appreciate the opportunity to share with you the importance of dementia training, standards, and certification. The Alzheimer's Association is the world's leading voluntary health organization in Alzheimer's care, support, and research. Today, you'll hear me use the words Alzheimer's and dementia. While Alzheimer's is the most common form of dementia, we work to support people living with any form of dementia. The Alzheimer's Association is committed to improving care and support for people living with dementia and their caregivers. In 2017, our chapter had nearly 6,500 local calls to our 24/7 helpline. We provided education to over 5,000 individuals and supported nearly 1,800 people through individual care consultations. We recently hosted our annual dementia conference, the largest in the Midwest, with Mayo Clinic. At that conference, we provided innovative education opportunities and powerful support to over 1,200 attendees, including individuals living with dementia, their care partners, professional caregivers, and medical professionals. You heard last week from one of the testifiers with the Care Imperative that they partner with us to provide training in their facility. We work with many care settings interested in this training to help prepare their staff to provide the quality care and support for their residents or patients living with dementia. In Minnesota, there are currently approximately 92,000 people over the age of 65 with Alzheimer's. Unfortunately, our work is growing more urgent. The number of Minnesotans living with the disease is expected to increase by over 30% by 2025. While many people living with dementia are able to continue living in their homes with care and support from their families and friends, many also live and receive care in long-term care settings, as we've heard today. Depending on the type of setting, between 40 and 60% of people in long-term care have some form of cognitive impairment or dementia. Also, please keep in mind that people living with Alzheimer's are more likely to have other chronic conditions that require more healthcare services. Among Medicare beneficiaries age 65 and older, 26% of them have five or more chronic conditions. Compare that to the population over 65 on Medicare without Alzheimer's, it's less than 4% who have five or more chronic conditions. Our current regulatory environment contains a mix of dementia training standards that vary by care setting. And Minnesota does not define minimum standards for dementia care beyond training. Minnesota only requires the disclosure of practices related to dementia care in the facility, and there's little or no regulation of that disclosure, let alone the practices outlined. This lack of definition results in differing standards of dementia care across care settings and confuses consumers. The public is already confused, as Ms. Scheller mentioned, about what defines housing with services, assisted living, home care, let alone what constitutes memory care within those settings. Those in late stages of dementia are among our most vulnerable, and often they cannot articulate when they're being harmed or their needs are not being met. To address this, the work group recommends a number of key priorities, including dementia certification and training. We call on the Commissioner of Health in consultation with other stakeholders, including consumers, dementia experts, and long-term care providers, regulators, to create dementia care standards and certification. As a part of licensure, dementia certification will ensure that all settings meet recognized standards to deliver quality care to handle the complex needs of those living with dementia, including therapeutic programming, physical environment standards. Care workers should be educated in in-person and family-centered care, communication skills, and specific and unique aspects of care and safety related for people living with dementia. The state should ensure that those standards are met to protect the health and safety of persons diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease or another dementia. The Alzheimer's Association recently revised and has released, just in February, dementia care practice recommendations, which outline recommendations on quality care practices based on a comprehensive review of current evidence, best practice, and expert opinion. We remain committed to bring our association's expertise to the table to improve the system for people living with dementia. I want to close by saying that we recognize and truly appreciate the dedicated professional caregivers and the facilities who provide safe, high-quality care for thousands of Minnesotans every day. We're committed to working together with all stakeholders to address these very complicated issues. However, we, all of us, the testifiers you've heard today, my colleagues on this work group, the regulators, the care providers, and you, our elected officials, must keep at the center of this conversation the individuals who are living in these care settings. We need to ensure that they get the high-quality care and protect them from abuse. That's the reason we're all here today. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. McMullen. Members, we have one more testifier, and we have 10 minutes left. So we'll call in Mr. Turcott? Excuse me, Chad, the police chief. Thank you. Welcome to our committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Chad Turcott. I'm actually the sergeant for the Pequot Lakes Police Department.
Good to know that.
Just to note that. I will try and keep this short in case there's any questions for anybody afterwards. I'm the member of Crow Wing County Adult Protection Team as well as Victim Services Board member in Crow Wing County. And I just want to share a few comics experiences that I've dealt with victims as well as family members from cases I've worked or are currently working. Now, I'll try not to discuss what's been discussed earlier other than I do feel that there is a need to license facilities and have different type of licenses or endorsements for the level of care. So in that way, families can easily go on a state website or the facility website, search county, city, statewide as far as what they're looking for their loved one, as far as where what can meet their needs of that person. And then also mandated oversight for mandated training for staff for those levels of facilities. Similar to in law enforcement, we have mandated training that the post-board audit certifies and everything else. Law enforcement needs additional assistance in many of these cases. During some of my recent cases, I've reached out to everybody I possibly could think of, including the FBI, which to my surprise, they're like, sure, we'll help you out, which I'm very thankful for, and I'm not here to talk negatively about any entity or anything like that, but when I get a MARC report and it's primarily based off of medical records and prescriptions, things like that, law enforcement is no expert as far as what medications are, how important they are, and such. So we need resources to help us investigate those cases. In one of my cases, there's a guardian involved, and that guardian had reported to law enforcement and the county attorney's office that there was no family members. And this was a case with a sexual assault. Through the work, our office was able to identify that there was a son who had actually moved to Pequot Lakes to be closer to the mother, but we were never told this. This wasn't a case where the court said, we're going to place this person in guardianship role because the son is a bad person. It was a case where the son had medical issues that were short-term where they could not provide the proper guardianship for this person. I strongly feel that there needs to be changes to where, in cases like that, family is notified so they know that there's something wrong with their loved one prior to reading it in the front page of the newspaper or seeing it on the news. There's no reason why it needs to be like that. They should have a right. I understand if it's an abusive relationship, then there may be a reason not to notify them family. But just because there's a guardian, there's not that automatic stigma that they're there to protect that person from their family. There's different levels. Likewise, there need to be responsibilities for guardians to notify the county attorney's office, law enforcement, that there are family members, because we may need to talk to them about an investigation regarding that person and such. I do agree with the civil penalties as far as not allowing those to pass upon the death of a vulnerable adult. And I was talked to somebody with our adult protection team this last week where the county had expended a lot of money on a resident who does not have any family, and there's fraud involved in that. So in those cases, I would just like to add the possibility of allowing a county or the state to step in to try and recoup some of those funds lost that could either go back towards the losses or put in a fund for education, training, oversight, additional supervision, or resources to help protect our elderly in assisted living or elsewhere. Unfortunately, law enforcement is not always notified if there's a death, and that's come more in light, at least for our agency, where, for example, a couple deaths we did not know about until OHFC had substantiated their investigations of neglect. That automatically puts us far behind if there is a chance or if there is a criminal action. Just because they find that there's a licensing violation does not mean that there's criminal action. However, if we don't find out that there's a death for 6 to 12 months after the event, if there is criminal neglect, that makes it very difficult for us to do our job, where it just needs to be changed. The other area where this could happen is if somebody is transported to the emergency room and then transported to St. Cloud or the cities, for example, and they pass away within a day. We don't necessarily get a MARC report. We're not notified that there's a death. So we're automatically caught behind. Where, in my opinion, law enforcement, OHFC, people should be notified if there's a death, including a hospice death. I know it's a lot more paperwork, a lot more work, but I feel that that would be the best benefit to oversight. Also, MARC reports are not always sent to the appropriate agency. If we have a facility in Pequot Lakes and their licensing organization is not in Pequot Lakes, there's many times that those MARC reports are sent to an agency where that licensed administrative office is, instead of our agency where the facility actually is. So we don't know what's going on all the time when it comes to those cases, and we only find out through other investigations that other reports were filed. And on a side note, I completed several MARC reports in the last 2 weeks, and I received a letter saying that one of my MARC reports was previously reported, and no investigation was going to be completed, which I'm okay with no investigation being completed, but which one out of a dozen MARC reports was it? I don't know which one it is. And so it makes it difficult. Furthermore, if it was already completed or sent through and gone through, I never got the initial MARC report saying that there was an incident. So there's several loopholes and pitfalls where things are falling through the cracks. The other area where eight entities need to work together. State statutes clearly says if there's any suspected criminal neglect or allegations, law enforcement is primary lead investigative agency. And this isn't about law enforcement, it's about the adults. But if I call certain entities and they say, yep, it looks like there may be neglect, but we can't tell you any information until it's published, that loses it. Another entity I contacted this last week said, we're investigating several complaints against one specific person that I'm also looking at, but we can't even tell you their name. We can't give you any information whatsoever. I don't know what they're investigating. Yes, I sent them what I was working on, because, again, it's about the adults. It's not about anything else. But I don't understand why there's all the barriers and the lack of working together with different entities to try and solve one issue and protect our elderly. So I think that's about 10 o'clock.
Thank you. Yes, it is. Thank you very much. We have a couple of questions. We'll try and get a couple in. I know we have another meeting coming in here. So Representative Tice, did you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, it's probably just an appointment finder thing. Sergeant Turcotte, I'd love to have in writing what you just talked about, some of the points that we can look at, because I'm finding out in my own area as well that there is kind of a lack of collaboration to get parties to talk. It seems like everybody wants to do their own thing and nobody wants to share information. Well, you can't really share information, but you know what I mean, strategies.
Absolutely.
So I would love that. I'll give you my card afterwards. And also, Sean Burke, we need to have another conversation. I have many questions. And also, Genevieve Gaborio, Thank you.
Good job.
Thank you for the cheat sheet. That helped grow. But I have so many questions because working with the police departments in my area, I'm finding out that, you know, we really aren't connecting on so many different levels, and there's a lot more that we can do. Not that I want to go, you know, after all the entities, but goodness, when there is something that can be done, we're not really touching bases and, you know, filling the gaps and doing all this, and it's kind of concerning. And, you know, one of the things that I look at is what happens to the file when a parent passes. I mean, do families get access to that file? Do you get to see what's going on? And I heard somebody mention that, you know, some things were not included in the file. So I'm just kind of wondering, you know, who has access to that afterwards? And these are questions that I'd love to have offline. We don't need to do it here, but just thank you very much for your testimony. We do have a lot to do.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Olson, did you have a question? Okay. All right. Members, I want to point out that this is our last scheduled subcommittee on aging and long-term care. As of today, we'll be done. But tomorrow, this is for the audience, too. We will start, I believe we have over 20 bills tomorrow in Health and Human Services policy, some of which will be on these issues. We'll begin to look at what we can pass, how we can deal with this. I have to say this has been a very heavy discussion, the whole session that we've had. As everyone knows, it's tragic. It's heart-rending. I have spent a lot of time in different situations taking care of family, and I'm sure many of you have too. It just makes me really sad to think that we have facilities that treat, or people that treat, our elderly or just vulnerable adults. I keep trying to remember this is not just elderly, and we need to value life no matter what stage it's in. And that is very important, and we will work very hard to address this. I hope you'll be patient. This is going to take some time. This is a huge, as you've heard, a huge problem. It's got tentacles everywhere, and we're going to have some challenges. I was just in property tax delivering a bill, and they were asking about what assisted living and housing with services paid in taxes, and I went, oh, yeah, I suppose we'll have that conversation somewhere along the route, too. Not as important as elderly abuse, certainly, and that'll go on the list of things later. But I thank you very much for attending, and with that, our meeting is